Hello and welcome to Football Memories and Moments. Basically, we've interviewed people who all share one thing, a love of football. In this podcast, we find out their favourite memory, something personal to them, and a moment that stands out forever. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please like, subscribe and rate. And our guest this week is Ian McIntosh. Now, Ian, as most of you know, is a prominent football journalist. He's also the founder of The Set Pieces, as well as the Totally Football Show podcast. And he kindly agreed to meet me in London, very short notice, and he went through his memories and moments. Ian is often accused of being a fan of many, many clubs, but he was more than happy to admit on record, on air, that he's actually a Southend United fan. And for his memory, we were able to go back to a very cold afternoon in 1991 for his first trip to his beloved Roots Hall. And then for his moment, which as you know is the second part of the podcast, we actually went back to a blissful summer. Alcohol was mentioned, girls were probably mentioned as well. But we couldn't just quite get over the idea that Paul Gascoigne didn't get his toe on that cross. All will be revealed as he comes. So on with the podcast.
It was 1991, and it was my dad took me. I think everyone's dad takes them to their first game, but this was different because my dad didn't actually like football. He was a copper, and football for him in the 70s and 80s was a fairly unpleasant experience. He'd been a West Ham fan as a kid, but he was adamant. No way he was taking me to a West Ham game. And to be honest, he had to be kind of pushed for any kind of game at all. I think he said once that football for him was essentially trying to stop one group of skinheads from stabbing another group of skinheads, which kind of sums up, you know, how awful it was at the time. I mean, not all football fans were bad, but there were, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on, and in comparison to the sort of Premier League sanitisation of football, which I think we can broadly agree has been on the whole for the best. Yeah, you know, there was some nasty stuff, and he didn't really fancy taking a little boy along to that. So he basically gave me a choice, because we lived in Chelmsford, and I had drifted, you see, I drifted to the dark side, because like anyone else in the home counties with a television in the 80s, the only football I'd really seen was Liverpool, because the only team that was ever televised was Liverpool and whoever Liverpool were playing. So I drifted down that direction, and he said, you've got straight choice, Colchester or Southend. Which I think in the history of straight choices has to be the worst. Yeah, yeah. There is no right answer there. But I took Southend because it was near the seaside. And the game was Southend-Huddersfield. And Southend at the time, I think, were top of the third division. And Huddersfield were like 18th. And it was January. And it was in that stage of the season where, like, if you're 18th in January, they were just high enough above the relegation zone for that not to be a worry. And miles off the chase for anything better than that. So, I mean, you would have put this down as your home win banker. Where accumulators are a thing in 1991. This would have been the one that you'd have based the entire weekend on.
So let's set the scene. I've been to Roots Hall. I went to Southend Tranmere about 18 years ago. It's a lovely little compact ground, if I remember rightly.
It's certainly a unique fixer-upper opportunity.
I've also been to Southend in the winter. It's not the warmest.
No.
So, and how old were you at the time?
I think I must have been about 12. And it was weird. I think most people might go to grander stadiums and have this point of entry, which is them walking up like eight flights of steps and then out for a tunnel, and this glorious sparkling arena opens up in front of them. For me, it was the turnstile, and then I would say about 12, 14 flat concrete steps. Which were already beginning to drip with piss. The waft of fried onions and booze and piss in your face. And at that time, it was the home fans were in the North Bank, and you all know the North Bank is kind of very overhanging, corrugated iron kind of roof, and it's dark and cavernous. And so that was it. It was like up the steps, and of course it's a grey day, it's overcast, and then that green and quite a lot brown pitch opens up in front of you, and it does. It just sort of, it's such a cliche now, but it really does make you go, like they've already got the floodlights on as well because it's January, so it looked really special. And then it was just the walk along the back of the North Bank, roughly into the middle, and then down kind of, you know, a little way, so you could get that perfect view where you can sort of see over the crossbar and see most of the pitch, and you're slightly to the right as well. Yeah. So my dad knew his angles. Didn't know his football, but he knew his angles.
Did you fall in love immediately?
Yeah, because it was so much more real. They had this very distant love affair with football that was based predominantly on, as I say, Liverpool on the telly, which wasn't even every week. Football was so unpopular in the 80s, they didn't even show one game a week. Some weekends they'd just go, you know what, we can't be asked, let's put a Columbo on again. And there just wouldn't actually be a game. So my formative years of football were spent like Match magazine, Shoot magazine, Match stats, making my own leagues, making my own dice game. Football was a very, very distant thing. And then to suddenly be kind of just dropped into the full sensory explosion of lower league football in the early 90s was just extraordinary. It wasn't even a kind of like or dislike or a love or not love. It was just a kind of holy shit explosion of things going on. And the language was amazing. Because when you're that age, swearing is the greatest thing ever. And even as you get older, it only diminishes into like the fourth or fifth greatest thing ever. But at that point, all of these grown-ups swearing all around you. And my dad looking at me and going, as long as you don't say it in front of your mum. And yeah, it was incredible.
Was he, I mean, as you say, he was a football fan, but did he allow himself to, did he enjoy the experience in terms of weight? Because even before the Premier League started a year later, football in the early 90s is post Italian 90, it is starting to turn okay again.
Yeah, it didn't really at Southend. I don't recall him particularly enjoying the day. Yeah, he didn't complain about it. He didn't moan. He just sort of took me in and let it unfold in front of me. I was probably faintly disappointed when I declared myself a Southend fan immediately afterwards. I think there was a period of trying to run the two things along at the same time, but then Liverpool went so bad and Southend went so good, there was actually a danger at one point that they might replace each other in the Premier League, which I don't think will ever happen again. I don't think anyone saw that coming.
Was that the time, if I'm vaguely remember, that Southend had a kit with, it had like a trim at the top?
They had the high-tech kit, blue and yellow.
Yes.
And they should never have changed from blue and yellow. It was gorgeous. There's I've got a picture somewhere. Weirdly, TalkSport did a series of postcards of just football scenes. And they picked this postcard that was my first game. It was it was a Huddersfield fan on his own in the away end on old wooden seats. And you could see the pitch and... You could actually see the North Bank where I would have been. It was such a weird, freakish coincidence to get this one game. And the colour, the blue and the yellow, just sort of standing out. I always remember Chris Powell as well. He was one of the greatest players that Southend have ever had. And he was playing that day. But I don't really remember too much about the game itself, just the experience.
Well, I was going to say, before we actually get onto the game, I just want to take your experience as a Southend fan and apply it to your, you know, what you do as a day job. Now, do you think being a Southend fan allows you to have a really good overview of what Premier League football is like? Because you don't appear to get involved too much and then you can make your judgments. I don't know if I'm getting that right or wrong.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits of supporting a lower league team is you haven't got a dog in the fight. That doesn't stop people accusing you. I mean, I'm generally regarded to be either a Manchester United fan or an Arsenal fan. But I think from a personal level, some journalists are really good at it. Like Danny Taylor, I think, is one of the best at The Guardian. Supports Nottingham Forest, writes about Nottingham Forest perhaps more than you would ordinarily expect of a journalist of his level, but always does it very, very well, I think. And there are some journalists who can balance that. I'm not sure if I could, and I'm glad I've never been tested. In fact, I tell a lie, I was tested. Southend had Chelsea in the FA Cup, and it would have been, I think, the first season that I did this for a living, and Chelsea were 1-0 up. It was while Scolari was there, And Southend hadn't had a sniff all game long. They hadn't had a sniff. And the 89th minute, we had a throw-in and Chelsea switched off and suddenly the ball was in the back of the net. And in a press box, you're not allowed to display emotion. There was some fist-punching. And I may even have turned round to a Chelsea supporting journalist and said some things. And it later transpired he wasn't a Chelsea supporting journalist, but you know, that emotion had to go somewhere. But fortunately, I haven't been put in that position again since. So, yeah, I think for me it helps. For everyone else, I'm probably still a Manchester United fan.
That's fair enough. What do you remember from the game? What was the score?
Well, as I say, Southend were top of the table and pushing for promotion. Huddersfield had nothing to play for, and so obviously Huddersfield won 1-0. I can remember nothing at all of the game apart from the fact that nothing happened aside from Huddersfield scoring. It was just an absolute nothing, utterly forgettable football match. And for that reason, the perfect introduction to life as a Southend United fan.
Did that almost help in a way? Because as you say, the explosion of the noise is the explosion of the smells. And you know, it's interesting, I did a Barrow game in the FA Cup about 3 years ago, and the smell of piss was quite prevalent there as well. Did the fact that there was nothing happening on the pitch allow you to soak all that in? Would you prefer some match action?
Yeah, I guess it probably did, because you were just looking around at stuff. I think I can remember a ball being tossed about on the north bank and going too high, smashing a fluorescent strip light and sending broken glass down onto the crowd. Though I might be getting my memories conflated with other games there. But there was just so much noise and smell going on. People, far better writers than me, will talk about the terrace as a kind of, yeah, like teeming organism, like a kind of living coral of humanity. And I think that's probably the nicest way that anyone's described the Southend crowd. It just was a great big smelly, sweary, homogenous lump of mankind.
I mean, you're probably aware that, you know, anyone who might be listening to this who will be of a certain age will be just wiping it away about how they used to want it to be.
Oh, the piss, the rivers of piss.
And how much of a hook was that game then for you? Obviously, you're a lifelong Southend fan, but was that a gradual thing, or were you in it?
Yeah, it was. That was it, really. You get torn between the prevailing wisdom that you can't change your team, and then gradually you get older. And as I say, for a while it was I like Liverpool and Southend, and then it became apparent that I actually couldn't pinpoint Liverpool on a map. I just kept pointing at Carlisle. And then it became more and more of a thing that, why am I a Liverpool? I shouldn't really, this has no relevance for me. This is someone else's story. And it just sort of drifted away. And as I got older, I was going to a few more Southend games, particularly the victory over Luton on the last day of the season that kept us up. Barry Fry and Stan Collymore, and that was extraordinary. And then I think, as with everything else, your identity strengthens much more when you go away from home, go to university for the first time. So it became even stronger there. So I'd come back on holidays and watch games. I've never forgiven Halifax Town, actually. I'd waited ages to go and see Southend. I was at university in Cornwall, came all the way back, watched Southend against Halifax. Halifax put every man behind the ball, and it was the nillest of nil-nils I've ever seen in my life. I've never forgiven them. And then gradually as I got older, I was able to go more often. Spectacularly broke after university, so it's just like games here and there. And then the last season before I got this job, I was going pretty much every home game, quite a few away games, really into it, really into the stride. And we got relegated that season back down into Division 3, and that was it. Unfortunately, the day-to-day football journalism thing, it makes it very, very difficult to get to Southend games. I mean, particularly, I'm trying to imagine saying to my wife after I've watched God knows how many games in a week, I've got a night off. You don't mind if I go to Southend, do you, to watch football?
Yeah.
It never goes well. Never goes well.
I'm just thinking the examples you've given of the 1-0 loss for your first game, a nillest of nil-nils, your first full season following relegation. In the words of Alan Shearer, alleged words of Alan Shearer to Glenn Hoddle, do you not think it might have been you?
It's quite possible. But the great thing about supporting a really crap football team is that when there are great moments, first of all, they're yours and yours alone. I mean, if you imagine, if you're a Liverpool fan, and you get Istanbul in 2005, the number of people around the world you've got to share that with.
Yeah.
The number of people who aren't from Liverpool, it might not even be from England, and and that's cool. People have got the people are allowed to support whoever they want and support in different ways. But it wouldn't just be yours. Whereas Southend beating Manchester United in the League Cup with that Freddie Eastwood goal from a free kick, that is mine and belongs to me and maybe 15 to 20,000 people at the very, very most. That's our memory and we don't have to share it with anyone. And that almost makes all the crap worth putting up with.
And it's kind of the final point on this, but from that memory to what is the best thing you've seen at Southend? I'm assuming, I think you've been to Wembley with them.
Yeah. Yeah, Southend actually went to the Millennium Stadium more, but I was there for Wembley for the Football League Trophy, which we duly lost, having sacked the manager 2 weeks beforehand. Best memory is probably that Barry Fry running around the pitch, swirling his cloth cap in the air. Stan Collymore getting so stripped for souvenirs, it was pretty much just in his pants at the end, being carried around by everybody. So that was great. And the Steve Tilson team, he basically got the job because he was pretty much the last person in the organisation with a tracksuit. Everyone else had been sacked. He'd genuinely been coaching like the under-10s, and there was no one else there. And so he got the job, and inexplicably, we had back-to-back promotions and the victory over Manchester United while playing really good football. And that was a great time because it wasn't so much one-off moments. It was just this long period of being really proud of your football team. It didn't have a pot to piss in, but we were playing the best football in the league and top of the table.
And just the final one is, if the the amazing happened and you ended up in the Premier League, would you be like, well, I knew them before they got famous?
Yeah, well, you do worry. I remember talking to a Reading fan years ago, because they sort of popped up and popped back down again and popped up. And he said, to be honest, mate, I prefer it in the Championship. Yeah, at least we get to win games. At least we've got a chance. You go into the Premier League and you're just trying not to get relegated. And that's it. So I'm quite happy with the way it is, to be honest.
Right, so what have you come for your memory?
It is the moment where Gazza lunges to try and put that cross in, that low cross in 1996, as being the moment when the party that was Euro 1996, you just knew it was going to end, badly.
Alex is full of running. Nesler loses out. England get possession. Played now to Teddy Sheringham. Trying to get Shearer on the far side. Onto the volley. No! Gascoigne went flying in there. And it looked as though it needed, well, it did need just the merest touch. And suddenly it looked as though England were into the final. Shearer's half-inch shot. Gascoigne just got a touch to it and no more.
I must have seen that a million times, and every time I think he's going to get it. And every time I don't understand how he didn't get it.
He stops.
Yeah, he just pauses for a moment and it's gone. And he stretches as far as he can. And believe me, even if you watch it frame by frame, you still think he's going to get it. And somehow, I don't know if it touches his boot, just takes a layer of polish just off the edge. But you just think that it's a matter of millimetres that he could have got enough on that. And that would have been it. England would have been into a final for the first time at that point in 30 years. But it was more than that, because it was the story of the whole summer. It was the story of the whole country at that time. And that was its end, because people will talk about Euro 96 as, the football coming home and all of that stuff. It wasn't so much football coming home. It was just England being happy with itself. Which feels even more poignant now when we're so divided and so incredibly awful. But it was the first time when everyone seemed quite pleased. We had thriving music scene, thriving film scene. British films hadn't been popular for years. And we were also just about to boot out the Tories. And it was so long in the coming that it was almost taken for granted. It was almost an entire year before it happened, but you knew it was going to happen. You knew that it was all going to change. So the country was just in this incredible place. It was the hottest summer, and probably the most pivotal thing in me considering this my golden age. I was 18 as well, so you didn't have to worry about not getting served in pubs.
Yeah.
I was 16 and I didn't have that fear either, to be honest.
Nice.
So, because I was a lot older for my age. Just to take this moment right back to what I think is its very start, Venables gets appointed.
Mm.
And do you remember just how bad some of that build-up to Euro 96 was? Because obviously, to remind some younger, possibly younger listeners, that we didn't have to qualify.
Yes, and people have this kind of false memory that Terry Venables came in and everything was brilliant and we hit the tournament and we're off. And they were talking about sacking Venables before the tournament started. Alan Shearer had gone something ridiculous, maybe even 20 games without scoring. So there were calls to drop Shearer, the greatest striker of his generation by a million miles, because there are always calls for stupid things at times. And it started quite well because it had taken over from Graham Taylor, and Graham Taylor, bless him, you know, a lovely bloke, and was put in a horrible situation, awful injuries, and apparently, you know, going back over that incredible documentary, appeared to be dealing with some quite extreme stress and anxiety at the time. That horrible bit where he's talking about sweating through his pyjamas every night, and you think, God, you're putting a brave face on this, but we know now what that was. And he had some appalling luck, but then Venables came in. It was kind of breath of fresh air, and that feeling was cemented by the gentlemen of the press, many of whom were drinking buddies with Venables, so there was a lot of positive press. And whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but it felt already there was a difference in perception. You've gone from having mock-up vegetables on the back pages of papers to suddenly having very encouraging stuff. But you also had, you know, we're coming into the sort of the lower hills of the Premier League's rise, as it was all getting very exciting. More exciting players were turning up. Foreign players were starting to be foreign players who were there because that was where they wanted to be, rather than that was the paycheck that they wanted. So Venables managed to get through quite a lot of it with not actually particularly impressive results or performances.
So looking back on it, you've got two basically coaching plans to put in practice. So if you're the England manager now, you can either have 2 years of awful planning, or you can have one flashpoint incident of a load of ale in Hong Kong, which creates a siege mentality.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, there's 23 players all fighting for each other because the press want them kicked out the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, when you go back to that performance against Holland, the 4-1, and 4-1 doesn't do it justice. We blew them away. And the movement and the recognition of where everybody was, that kind of cohesiveness, that comes through 2 years of trying to do that, 2 years of practice. Yeah, it looked awful, but it was obviously it was beginning to pay off. So it was all kind of worth it at the time. Though even the tournament itself didn't get off to a great start. We had an extraordinary opening ceremony, which, as I recall, had a man in a cardboard suit of armour chasing a man in a dragon outfit as a kind of St George thing, and then a dreadful game against Roy Hodgson's Switzerland. Was it Roy Hodgson? Yeah. He might have gone by then.
No, it was.
It was Roy Hodgson.
Yeah.
And a 1-1 draw. Yeah. And then you've got the game against Scotland where it's not a comfy ride at all. Gary McAllister doesn't score the penalty. And suddenly it all changes. And on that, everything changes.
I was going to say, though, that 2 minutes from the McAllister penalty miss, I believe, you know, we all think we've got to thank Yuri Geller for that.
Yes.
And then to Gascoigne scoring maybe the second best goal of his career. I was thinking the goal against Oxford in the Cup.
Well, this coming not long after Piers Morgan had called for him to be booted out of the England team, which then, of course, led to the famous Mirror front page full apology. You have to go back before the tournament and remember the headlines, remember the trouble that the England team were in for doing the drinks in Hong Kong, for smashing Seven Shades of Shit out of their aeroplane on the way back from Hong Kong, the collective responsibility. There were a lot of people out to get them. There were a lot of people hoping that they'd lose. But at the same time, you also had... I do think this is a really important thing. You had a really good song in Badil and Skinner. And I know it seems really cliched and everything, but I remember me and a mate in the car, and Radio 1 were playing it for the first time. And we were going, oh, God, this is going to be awful, isn't it? And I was like, that's really... I've got goosebumps. You know, there it was almost like there were two realities by that point. The England 1996 reality in the press,
yeah,
all doom and gloom and disaster, and no one scoring, and we're out of form. And then the reality of me and my mates, all 18 years old, and we're getting served in pubs, and we're seeing real boobs in real life, and people have got cars, and it's hot and sunny, and we've done our A-levels, and we're all free. It was just like these two completely different realities at the same time.
Just on that point, though, and I think it's quite important to make, is that I always felt that Skinner's verse was quite weak. Sorry, back to the game. So, again, another side is there seemed to me that there was just loads of little victories that ultimately were leading to a bigger victory. One of them being the Dutch game. It was the first time I think you could actually say, and no one would laugh at you, well, we've just out-Dutched the Dutch. But then we let them score at the end, and that leads Scotland
down. Which, being of Scottish descent myself, I didn't take any real joy in that, but I know a lot of my friends did. We had that, and you just had, there were so many little things. I think primarily the team was really likeable.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it was maybe just the last days of footballers still having some kind of relevance to normal people, as opposed to nowadays where they might as well live on the moon for all that they've got in common. They were just they were just lads. They liked to drink. They liked playing football. There was character there, and you could sort of get on board with that. Obviously, the British press didn't at the time.
They were very much off.
The rest of us, they thought, are all behind it.
You talk about Taylor's luck, and you talk about Venables' luck. Was Venables, you know, you think lucky managers, people, you know, Mourinho's got very lucky, the fact that Lukaku's come out well, etc., etc. Venables was lucky that Gary Neville all of a sudden turned up in the seat. McManaman starting to fulfil his potential every week. Nick Barmby comes in and starts playing well, you know, getting the squad ahead of Beardsley.
I mean, when it comes to luck, I think there are other factors. I mean, with Gary Neville, you've got to remember the criticism and ridicule that Venables got for putting Gary Neville in the team, because I think he'd only played something like 12 times for Manchester United when he got his England debut, which is kind of normal now because there's only about 17 people eligible to play for England in the Premier League. But in those days, it was like, what are you... You need three seasons at least before you get in that England team. He made his own luck on that front. But then you've got Spain. You know, the game against Spain in the first knockout round. It's just laughable that England got through that. Mm. It was as flat a performance as the Switzerland game. I'll try to think because it was a game I watched in the pub. But I'm fairly sure there was at least one, possibly two, entirely legitimate goals ruled out for offside, mm-hmm. Which were probably the kind of thing that, had it been a tournament held in another country, I think we might have made more of.
Exactly, it was at the tunnel end, if I remember rightly. It was at the tunnel end. And that game itself, building up to, is that, I mean, you know, I'm an Evertonian. I am very much used to, it's not the disappointment, it's the hope that kills you, not the disappointment. We're building up because we have 6 years later, we have Pierce's redemption.
Yes.
And that is a moment, you know, we've spoken to other people about the emotions of sport, is that you can, even your knowledge of what, like, thinking that Stuart Pearce is a bit mad now, even now I can watch that, and I don't know what it's like for you, and Pierce's,
goosebumps already. We haven't even really got into it.
So when you watched that time, can you remember watching that time and how you felt?
Yeah, feeling sick with anxiety for him. Not even for the team, but just for him. That he had to get up and go through that all over again. And then, I mean, millions of people have talked about it since, but having those 2 or 3 seconds of him just walking away like you'd just, you know, replaced a light bulb, and then all of a sudden it all comes roaring out of his face, was just, I can't stop grinning thinking about it. It was just brilliant. But there again, I haven't felt like that about an England team for years. I think maybe 2006 was the year that it was done for me, that it was such a good, such a talented set of players, and they were appalling all the way through it. So 2004 was the last time I think I got into supporting England.
Yeah.
Which is really, really sad. I hope it does change, but you need something you can get behind. You need something you can believe in, feel affinity to. You need it to feel like it's your team.
Yeah.
And I haven't felt like that for a long, long time.
But that comes from what you said before, is that the level of disconnect between the players.
Yeah.
You know, and also, but there's a huge level of disconnect now between, you know, the press. the front pages of the press, I think it's quite important to make that clarification, is that we're out to get the players, but the back pages possibly still try to protect them a little bit. Whereas now you have that disconnect between journalists, media, and fans, because you know as well as anybody else does, you can't interview a player now without a PR person standing in front of you. So do you think that was the last sort of glorious summer of that?
To be honest, I wouldn't be able to answer that because I wasn't a journalist at the time, yeah. And I wasn't until 2007. But certainly some of the older boys will... this was an era where you go out and get pissed with the players.
Yeah.
There's one story about... it just sums this up. It's around about that period. And it involved one journalist and John Hartson. I think I can name, because he comes out of this quite well.
Okay.
But John Hartson and this journalist, they go out drinking. And towards the end of the night, it's just that point where everyone's so clattered that things get misconstrued, and journalist and John Hartson have a fight. And next morning, the journalist wakes up and he gets a phone call from Hartson, and Hartson says, I don't know why we started fighting last night, but I just want to say I'm really sorry, and I really hope I can't have this in the papers. And the journalist is like, the fuck would I put it in the papers for? Don't be daft. I was a dickhead. It was my fault. Don't worry about it. We'll go for a pint later. And you just think, God, that level of closeness, yeah, and trust.
Yeah.
I don't think that... Yeah, it's been... It's going to be a long time before players and journalists are getting drunk again together.
Exactly. So we sneak through the quarterfinals, and then we arrive at the semi-final. It's a midweek game. It's a night time. We're in that horrible, horrible grey kit.
Yeah.
And... it's like any situation, isn't it? England take the lead too early.
Yeah, my mate has a theory about this. He says if England go behind early, then it's going to work out all right, because it's a slap around the face they need. If they go ahead early, it can go in the opposite direction. By then, though, it was starting to feel like it was going to happen, because we're beating Scotland. That was about our level, trying to just get one over the Scots. And then we're beaten and outplayed the Dutch. And then we're just squeezed by in a freakish game against the Spanish. And so it was like, well, what do we have to fear from Germany? We don't have to fear. And we've done, like, at that time, I think people kind of respected the Dutch more than the Germans.
Yeah, it was considered a weak German side.
Yeah, so why should they stop us? Why should they? And the game was pretty even. You know, and then they come back into it and it's 1-1 and... suddenly it's dragging on, but you're still thinking it's at Wembley, it's a partisan crowd. And if you believe in your energies and that, you've got 25 million people watching at home, like half the population's watching it, and everyone's into it. And then it happens. And the thing about how profound the impact of that cross and Gascoigne not reaching the ball is that I was actually talking to Darren Anderton a couple of months back, and he reminded me that he hit the post.
Yeah.
I was like, I completely forgotten.
Because the question I was going to ask you is that in my head, I was going to say about the post, but for some reason I've got my games mixed up, because Waddle hit the post in 90.
Do you remember?
And
yeah.
So I was going to ask, is because you're saying about it's at home, it's not a great German side. The 90 German side was a great, or the West Germany side. But there are parallels between the two games, aren't there?
Yeah, it was... I just cannot remember him hitting the post. Again, you know, drink had been taken. But when he couldn't reach the ball, you were just like, it's not going to happen, is it? It's just not going to happen.
Let's take one of my most favourite things ever. And to be fair to him on Twitter, he's a very good sport about it. But I think, can we apply a Newman and Badil breakdown of the Jeff Thomas shot against France?
Right.
And apply it. Have you ever seen it?
Oh, yes.
Yes, he's very, very good on Twitter about it, Jeff Thomas, to be honest. So let's break it. Is that how, when you see it, do you get upset? I mean, there's a great Robin Williams film, isn't it, where he goes and sees a prostitute every week and he doesn't have sex with her because he just wants to talk about the touchdown he misses. Now, I'm not, you know, saying you're going to go down that route, but do you look at it and think, do you ever think in any reality he's going to score?
What, the
Gascoigne?
Every time I watch it, I think he's going to score. Every single, we could put it on YouTube now and I'd watch it and I'd go, he's got this. I'd be leaning in, he's got this. Every time. And then it slips away. And when penalties come, I think everyone's emotions are just so frazzled at that point that you can't compute, you're not processing logic. That my abiding memory of that penalty shootout is Stuart Pearce stepping up, me feeling sick for him all over again, thinking, oh God, he's just exercised 6 years worth of demons. He's going to miss.
Yeah.
He's going to miss and it all starts again. Of course he didn't. He puts it away. But then it's just not enough.
And when, you know, and he got a, you know, he got a Pizza Hut commercial out of it, so all great. But when Southgate steps up, do you? I mean, I'm a 16-year-old watching it, and I know he's not scoring.
Yeah, I think you could see it in his body language. But I'd never have a word of criticism directed at him because he got up, he took it. You know, there were another five outfield players there, some of whom you back to score, and they didn't get up. He got up. Knowing, because he's an intelligent bloke.
Yeah,
you know, he knew what it meant. He knew what the history and the significance. He knew that the people watching at home. Maybe that's what went wrong. Maybe he just had too long on that walk to think about it all, and it went. But no, I'd never blame him for a moment. But it's funny after that. A mate of mine I was watching with at the time. He remembers the German guy who scored the goal that ended it. It was like a. Coup de grace, and he remembers him strutting in front of the England fans. I have no memory of it at all because I think my head was in my hands.
Yeah,
I think it was. I couldn't even watch it by that point.
Just a bit of hypothesising in our alternate reality, but Southgate scores.
Mm.
Venables would have had to have gone because of the business stuff, wouldn't he? But would we have seen a golden era for England after that?
Yeah, I don't think he would have had to go. He needed to be backed, and he needed to be believed in. I always felt that separation was unnecessary, that it really shouldn't have come to that. At some point, someone could have rode back on something and made that, just stop that being a thing. But then maybe it's best that that's how it ended, because you have that memory, you have that summer, that extraordinary summer, which ended that night. I think we all sat in the garden, very hot summer's night, with a load of tins, and I think.
Was that a nice edit point?
Sorry. Not really. I think we sat in the garden with a load of tins, hot summer night, and I think we must have all got through two cans before words were even exchanged. Just sat very, very sadly. And even though that's not when the summer ended, it feels, in my memory, that's when the best summer ever finished.